your fingers bleed.
Hello, CJSF listeners. It's Steve Chong, the host of the Steve Chong Show. We'd like to appreciate you because without your support, CJSF wouldn't be able to produce grassroots content that are rarely, if ever, addressed by major media outlets, which are being more consolidated than ever, along with massive layoffs. Tune in to the Steve Chong Show on Fridays between 3 and 4 p.m., where you could listen to independent music, non-mainstream sports such as the SFU Athletics, with the background and the latest on the Surrey Police transition, which will have huge impact in public safety across British Columbia.
The end of poverty will require new policies. It will require new movements, for sure. I want to end poverty in America. Why settle for anything less? Like, why accept the boring, pernicious, best we can do-ism that has gripped the American imagination in recent years?
That's Matthew Desmond, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Matthew Desmond, Ending Poverty in America. Why does the United States, the richest country on earth, have more poverty than any other advanced democracy? Why does this land of plenty allow one in every eight of its children without basic necessities, permit its citizens to live and die on the streets, and allows its corporations to pay poverty wages? There's plenty of money for F-35s, aircraft carriers, and military bases all over the world, but very little for the least advantaged among us. What perpetuates poverty, and what can be done to end it? Poverty persists, says Matthew Desmond, because the rest of us benefit from it. Our guest today is Matthew Desmond. He's a professor of sociology at Princeton University. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of Evicted, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. And his latest book is Poverty, Buy America. He spoke in Seattle in late March 2024. And now, Matthew Desmond.
I'm from the West Coast. I was born in San Jose, California, but I grew up in Winslow, Arizona. You know, our family never had a lot of money, and Dad was a preacher, and we experienced some of the indignities of poverty and scarcity. Family declared bankruptcy. The bank took our home before it was all the rage. And I think that started me on this journey. That started me on this question about why. Why is that how you handle a family when they fall on hard times? You know, why do we have so much poverty in America? Because we have way more poverty than other peer democracies. Our child poverty rate isn't just higher than other countries. It's double. It's double what it is in Canada. It's double what it is in South Korea or Germany. You go to Europe, Europeans have this phrase, American-style deprivation. So about one in three of us live in homes making 55K or less. And many of those families aren't officially considered poor, but literally, what else do you call it? Trying to raise two kids in Seattle on $55,000 or less. Now, as a lived experience, there's plenty of poverty above the poverty line. And there's plenty far below it, too. 38 million Americans fall below the official poverty rate drawn by our government, which means that if America's poor got together and founded a country, that country would have a bigger population than Australia. There's growing evidence that this country harbors not just poverty, but this hard bottom layer of poverty, the kind of deprivation we thought only existed in faraway places of bare feet and swollen bellies. Poverty is measured at these different income levels, right? But that's not how it's experienced. It's experienced as this exhausting piling on of problems, as chronic pain on top of tooth rot, on top of debt collector harassment, on top of the nauseating fear of eviction. It's the suffocation of your talents and your dreams. It is death come early and often. So far from a line, poverty's like this tight knot of humiliations and agony, and its persistence in American life means that millions of us are denied safety and security and dignity in the richest country in the history of the world. So why? So some have suggested, well, there just ain't nothing you can do about it. You know, you're going to always have the poor, and the government shouldn't help, really can't do anything. And that's just a lie. There's a ton of evidence showing that government programs are effective, are essential, lifting millions of families above the poverty line every year. And just think back a little bit in history when the War on Poverty and the Great Society was launched in 1964. LBJ launched it, first year in his inauguration. These were this deep investment in the poorest families in America, this bundle of domestic policies that made food aid permanent, expanded Social Security. Finally, we got a public health insurance through the War on Poverty. Real investments, real reach. So what was the return on that investment? 10 years after the War on Poverty was launched, the poverty rate was cut in half. It was half of what it was in 1960. It's a big difference. So if we have a lot of evidence that government programs work, and we have a clear historical case of their working, maybe we have so much poverty in America because we've stopped trying to help. We've rolled back spending. And I used to think that was the story, but that's not the story, actually. The reality is a lot messier. So if you look at the 13th biggest means-tested programs in the country, these are programs we usually think about when we think about welfare, food stamps, housing assistance, Medicaid, things like that. So spending on those programs went from about $1,000 a person the first year into Ronald Reagan's administration to about $3,400 a person the first year into Trump's administration. That's a big increase, about 230% increase. It's adjusted for inflation. So the country hasn't got stingier over time. The opposite is true when it comes to fighting poverty. And this makes the persistence of poverty even more baffling and confusing because decade after decade, poverty persists, even as anti-poverty spending has increased. It's hard to measure poverty. What's very hard to ignore is the fact that like evictions have increased by 22% since 2000. The share of families visiting food pantries to eat, that's up 19% since 2000. The number of homeless public school kids has increased by 74% since the Great Recession. Bad debt, non-mortgage debt held by low-income families, that's up 200% since the 80s. And since the 90s, the number of Americans receiving food stamps but claiming no other cash income has more than quadrupled. These are troubling signs, you know? They mean that for scores of us, American life is indignity. American life is unsafety. American life is hunger. Why? So I think we could start getting at this question by realizing that a dollar in the budget isn't a dollar in someone's hand necessarily. And I remember watching this process play out in real time with my friend Wu. So Wu and I lived together in Milwaukee. We met when I was working on my last book, Evicted. And we shared a rundown rooming house in the inner city. And one day, Wu stepped on a nail in that rooming house and didn't pay it any mind. You know, he just worked two jobs. He never sat down. But that injury started getting infected. And when that infection was accelerated by his diabetes, the doctor decided to take his leg before the infection took all of him. And so Wu and I had a good cry in the hospital together. But then we got down to work. I helped him apply for disability. His application was flat out rejected. Wu was not surprised about this at all. He was like, this is how it always is. And he hired a lawyer. So lawyers working on contingency can receive about a quarter of the back pay their clients receive when they are waiting for aid. And I started looking into this, and I realized that Wu's story is part of a bigger pattern. Every year in America, $1.2 billion in Social Security aid doesn't go to people that have disabilities. It goes to people like Wu's lawyer to help them get on disability. And that's Wu's story. You know, with the lawyer's help, he was able to win his case. He received $3,400 in back pay. He bought a wheelchair accessible van that ran for a couple years and lit on fire. And his lawyer took home a few hundred bucks. Wu never lost any sleep that his lawyer got paid. And I get it, that lawyer performed a great service. But like, I also can't get over the fact that every year $1 billion in Social Security aid is not flowing to folks that need it the most. So a dollar in the budget doesn't necessarily mean a dollar in the hand. You know, sometimes the welfare state is a leaky bucket. But it's also important to recognize, I feel, that a lot of this dynamic is caused by the fact that people are not getting connected to programs that they really could use. We hear so much about welfare dependency in America. We heard about it like nonstop during COVID. We're like paying people to stay home. If you look at the data, there's not a lot of evidence for welfare dependency. You know what there's a lot of evidence of? Welfare avoidance. You know, the fact that billions and billions of dollars in unused aid are left on the table every year. So about 7 million workers who could receive something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a wage subsidy for our poorest paid workers, they pass on it. So they collectively pass on $17 billion a year. If you add that up to the amount of money that goes unclaimed by people who could receive but don't claim, food stamps and unemployment insurance, government health insurance, supplemental security income, just those handful of programs, you're already up to over $140 billion in unclaimed aid every single year. That's not a picture of welfare dependency. That's a picture of us doing a crummy job connecting families to these programs that they need and deserve. But an even bigger reason why we have so much poverty in America today is that the job market is not pulling its weight. Now, a few years ago, I met Julio Paez in Emeryville, California. So this is what Julio's life looked like. He'd start his day at 10 p.m., clocking at McDonald's and work the graveyard shift from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. And then he'd have 2 hours to rest and shower. And then he'd clock in at Aerotech, going anywhere the temp service sent him between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. And then he'd sleep as much as he could, and then it was back to McDonald's. Each job paid minimum wage. Julio told me he had to work this much to afford the little room he shared with his brother and his mom in the Bay Area. But he was like, Matt, I feel like a zombie. You know, he was either working or sleeping with no life in between. And one day, his little brother, Alexander, who was 8 at the time, went up to Julio and was like, bro, I'm saving up my money. And Julio was like, why, little man? And Alexander was like, I want to buy an hour of your time. How much for an hour to play with me? And when Julio heard that, he just wept. And not long after, he collapsed in the aisle of a grocery store. He fainted from exhaustion. He was 24 years old. It wasn't always this bad. In the 1950s, in the 1960s, a third of the American workforce carried a union card. Wages were going up pretty steadily every year. CEO pay was reined in, and we experienced the most equitable time in modern history. But as workers lost power, their jobs got a lot worse. One sociologist put it like this: our grandparents and our parents have jobs and we complete tasks. It's like the story of the working poor, the working class anyway. And this is a key reason why poverty has persisted in America decade after decade, even as anti-poverty spending has increased. When the War on Poverty and Great Society were launched in the 60s, unions were strong, and wages were coming in at a strong living rate, even for the poorest workers. But in today's economy, unions are weak, and wages are falling. For men today without a college degree, their inflation-adjusted wage is less, on average, than it would have been 50 years ago. When the job market was delivering for the average worker, anti-poverty programs were cures. Today, the job market has turned those programs into something like dialysis, a treatment to make poverty less lethal, but not make it disappear. So this is one answer to our puzzle. We have so much poverty because the poor are exploited, which is a word I feel like we should use a lot more than we do today. And they're exploited not just in the labor market, but in the housing and financial markets as well. As this city well knows, the rental housing market is brutal. Since 1985, rents have outpaced income gains by 325%. Or consider every year, $11 billion in overdraft fees, 1.6 check cashing fees, almost $10 billion in payday loan fees are pulled from the pockets of the poor. That is $61 million just in fines and fees pulled out of their pockets every single day. When James Baldwin famously wrote how expensive it is to be poor in America, I don't think he could have imagined these receipts. I read across this line by Tommy Orange, the novelist. It goes like this: kids are jumping out of the windows of burning buildings, falling to their deaths, and we think the problem is that they're jumping. And when I read that, I was like, that's the American poverty debate. You know, for over 100 years, we've focused on the poor themselves, and we've asked every conceivable question we can about their family and their work ethic and their children, and they're the jumpers. We should have been focusing on the fire. Like, who lit it? Who's warming their hands by it? So who benefits from all this exploitation? So corporations benefit from labor exploitation, of course, but so do many of us who consume the cheap goods and services the working poor produce. It's easy to talk about shareholder capitalism like it's 12 dudes in a Manhattan boardroom, but half the country's invested in the stock market. Don't we benefit when we see our savings go up like magic, even when that comes at the kind of a human sacrifice that people like Julio bear? Payday lending, industries, banks, they fit on the financial exploitation of the poor. But so do those of us with free checking accounts, because it turns out they're not free. They're subsidized by billions of dollars in overdraft fees charged basically to 9% of bank clients, the poor made to pay for their poverty. And I know this can be a hard pill to swallow, and it can sometimes cause us to reach for more absolving theories of poverty, even stupid ones. So I've been on the beat, the housing beat, for a long time, and everywhere I go, talking about the affordable housing crisis and trying to find out the causes of that crisis, someone will pull me aside and tell me in a very grown-up voice, you know what it is? It's the Russian oligarchs. It's the Russian oligarchs. That's why Seattle has a housing crisis. They're buying up all the buildings. They're haunting the housing markets of LA and Honolulu and Austin, Texas. And pretty soon I was like, bro, how many oligarchs are there though? Like, can't be that many. But it is easier to talk about them than to talk about, like, us. You know, the fact that it's not only landlords that profit from the housing exploitation of the poor, it's also homeowners. Our property values propped up by our collective efforts to make housing scarce and expensive. I told you that spending on poverty has gone up, and that's true. No one disputes this. But that doesn't mean we've caught up with our peer nations in this regard. With respect to the share of our GDP dedicated to expanding opportunity, we're lagged behind a lot of advanced democracies. And that's because we decide to do something else with our money. We decide to subsidize affluence instead of alleviate poverty. So every year in the country, we spend about $1.8 trillion on tax breaks for like you name it, right? College savings plans, retirement plans, health insurance plans, wealth transfers. That's double what we spend on the military, actually. And it's far, far outpacing everything we do to help the neediest Americans today. So if you think of like everything the government does for us, and if you add all that up, if you count things like every means-tested program that flow to the poorest Americans, things like food stamps, housing assistance, if you count social insurance programs like Social Security, which many of us receive today or will receive someday, and if you count tax breaks, and you gotta count tax breaks, you know, they cost the government something and they put money in our pocket. If you receive a tax break, you can deduct that from your income, or the government could just mail you a check. It's the same accounting. So if you add all that up, here's the bottom line. You learn that the average family in the bottom 20% of our income distribution, our poorest families, they receive about $26,000 a year from the government. But the average family in the top 20%, our richest families, They receive about $35,000 a year from the government. That's almost a 40% difference. Like, this is the true nature of our welfare state, and it's another core reason why poverty persists in America, because we give the most to families that need it all, like have plenty already. And then we have like the audacity, like the shamelessness to then fabricate stories about poor people's dependency on government aid and shoot down proposals to reduce their hardship because, man, they'd cost too much. You know, glancing at the price tag of some program that would reduce child poverty by half or make sure all of us have access to a dentist, our representatives suck their teeth and ask, like, yeah, it's a great idea, but like, how can we afford it? I just don't know how we can afford it. It's such a dishonest question. It's a sinful question. One asked if the answer wasn't staring us straight in the face. We could afford it if the richest among us took less from the government. We could afford it if we did less to guard fortunes and more to fight poverty. I want to talk about one other way affluent Americans create poverty. We build walls around our communities. These walls are made up of laws. There may be no phrase more soulless in the English language than municipal zoning ordinance. But it's a pretty good window into the soul of a community, actually. So today, on most residential land, it is illegal to build anything other than a single detached family home. This is a very strange way to have a civilization. And it's another key way we create poverty today, because when we create communities of concentrated affluence, there's a side effect. Communities of concentrated poverty. Democrats are more likely to support the idea of public housing, but they are no more likely to vote for it in their own neighborhoods. A recent study showed that conservative renters were more likely to support affordable housing in their community than liberal homeowners. Maybe we're not so polarized after all. Maybe above a certain income level, we're all segregationists. And we can decorate our walls with rainbow flags or don't tread on me flags, but the wall remains the wall, indifferent to our decorations. I think there's so much poverty here, not in spite of our wealth, but because of it. So how can we finally put an end to it? How can we abolish poverty in America? Well, one way to get this question, I think, is just to ask, well, what's the price tag? How much would it cost? How much would it cost to end poverty in America? So it would take about $177 billion a year to bring everyone below the official poverty line above it. This is a very rough estimate, but it's a good place to start. You know, it gives us a sense of what we're talking about when we're talking about ending poverty in America, because what we're talking about is something that's just so utterly attainable. Like, this is less than 1% of our GDP. By one estimate, we waste more in food every year than this. Recent studies showed that if the top 1% of income earners just paid all their federal income tax, not got taxed more, just paid their tax, we as a country could raise an additional $175 billion a year. We could just about close the poverty gap if the richest among us paid what they owed. Please don't tell me this rich nation of dollars can't afford to do more. But we don't just need deeper investments. We need different ones. We need policies that disrupt poverty, that threaten its very survival. Because if we fail to address all those forms of exploitation at the bottom of the market, we could get policies that get watered down, even canceled out, which means we have to find ways to empower the poor. Let's start with jobs. The best way to address worker exploitation is through worker empowerment. Unions have a pretty good track record of bringing power into the workplace. But as today's labor movement stands, unions are weak, and organizing a workplace is incredibly hard. Do you remember how excited we were that one Amazon warehouse, maybe unionized? How are we going to get hundreds and then thousands of them to follow suit? You got to go one Starbucks location, one warehouse at a time. There's no way we're going to empower America's workforce like this. This is why the new labor movement, a multiracial, not your father's labor movement, is trying something different. They're trying to organize entire sectors instead. So here's how it might work. Say everyone in a certain sector of the economy, like food and hospitality, took a vote. And if all the workers said, or enough workers said, yeah, I want to go for it, it would trigger a process where the Secretary of Labor would bring together worker representatives, corporate representatives, government officials, to organize and collectively bargain for terms that would cover the entire industry. This is the way to organize all those baristas or all those warehouse workers in a single go. Nerds call it sectoral bargaining, and it's alive and well in Europe. This isn't an anti-capitalist proposal. It's an anti-exploitation proposal. This is a proposal that I think could get us closer to something like the capitalism we deserve. What about housing? What about the fact that most renting families below the poverty line are spending most of their income on housing costs? I think what works in Seattle is not going to work in Milwaukee. And what works in Milwaukee is not going to work in the Delta. I think there's a lot of different ways to address the housing crisis. So here's just one solution out of many. What if we made a real attempt to bring homeownership to more working families? So a few years ago, I met Lakia Higby. She was an Amazon picker. She lived in this house in North Cleveland, Ohio, with her two adult kids, few grandkids. She paid $950 in rent for this house. She had lived there for years and years and years. Now, if Lakia bought that house under conventional mortgage standards, her monthly payment would drop to about $570 a month. That means she would be $4,500 richer every single year with no rent hikes. That's real money. But even if Lakia had perfect credit, and even if she was able to save for a down payment, the chances of a bank doing business with her were really slim. Not because she's a riskier investment. The foreclosure rates for low-income mortgages, low-income housing, they're the same as the foreclosure rates for high-income housing, very expensive mortgages. But those two mortgages bring in a lot different profits. If you're a bank, you'd much rather underwrite $1 million mortgage than a $50,000 one. This is where philanthropy and government could step in, incentivizing lenders to get in the business of doing business with people like Lakia. And Seattle, you might be thinking, there's no affordable homes left. But like last year, across the country, 27% of homes sold in America were sold for under $100,000. But only 23% of those, a minority of those, were financed with a mortgage. Most others were gobbled up by real estate speculators or landlords. Look, this is one solution out of many. There isn't a right way, I think, to solve the affordable housing crisis. I think there is a wrong way. The thing we're doing now.
You're listening to Matthew Desmond, Ending Poverty in America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Okay, we got to take one more step. We got to do one more thing. And this is a word especially for my affluent whites in the audience, which is our walls. Our walls have to go. Like, what are we teaching our kids when they plainly see us barring the doors of opportunities for other kids and doing it in their names? The best thing we can do policy-wise is to take all those exclusionary zoning laws that riddle cities like Seattle and replace them with inclusionary zoning. Exclusionary zoning says it's illegal to build any kind of affordable housing. The best inclusionary zoning laws say it's illegal not to. Study after study after study shows that when affordable housing is well built, when it blends into the community, it has zero effect on property values. Zero. But the segregationists don't